colleagues, let's we would want to commence this our meeting. Can we, Dombi, can you close the door behind you? Thank you very much. Let's start by welcoming the minister to this meeting. Members of the Portfolio Committee on Economic Development, members of the Select Committee on Economic Development, and members from the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. Some members are here. I can see them. You're welcome and thank you very much, especially the chair. I can see the chair from the Select Committee on Economic Development and Energy. That's what you call the committee. Welcome and thank you really for making space for this meeting, time and space for this meeting. And the chair for the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry will be joining us in due course. She's attending another meeting, Minister. I can see we also have the media in our midst. We also have other guests from other departments and other institutions. Thank you for joining this meeting. This is quite an important meeting for us as a committee. Wherein we're going to be getting a briefing from the minister on the global economic crisis framework, I mean response framework. This briefing is quite important. I think it comes at the right time where I guess everybody's speculating as to what will happen going forward. There are many people who are speculating, and unfortunately the reports also that we've been receiving for the past week are telling us stories that we are not used to, and listening to various specialists and academics, it's quite clear that it's quite a time, Minister, where in everybody is not quite clear as to what is happening and what to look for. But I guess today you will be able to give us a glimpse of what is happening in terms of our economic profile, and also you will get into issues related to what exactly is South Africa doing to respond to the economic situation domestically, and also how do we intend, or how are we already interacting globally. So I will then, without the waste of time, colleagues and those who are our guests, given the opportunity to the minister to give us the presentation. We are not going to start the usual way, Minister. As you will know that we have invited our sister committee. We will just allow you to zoom into the presentation or the briefing, and then we'll be able to then get questions of clarity, comments from colleagues, and after we have concluded that session, we will then remain as a committee to continue with our meeting, or to conclude our meeting. Yes, there are still, the department is still making more copies. Those who haven't yet received their copies, please plead with us. But also, I guess, in terms of the presentation, I don't know, Minister, are you fully ready? Because I hear that there are still copies. You're ready. Okay. Over to you, Minister. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning to colleagues, both from the two committees as well as officials and members of the media. I'd like to start by saying that the purpose of today's briefing is to share with the committee, over the Portfolio Committee and the Select Committee, progress that we've made in implementing the framework commitments. And I regard today's briefing as particularly important because I would like to see this engagement with the Portfolio Committee as a vital part of what government does. We look for this discussion to give us some fresh ideas, for you to contribute in a number of ways to how government respond. So this is a very useful opportunity, and I'd like to thank the Chair for creating this platform for ourselves. I start, colleagues, with a very brief background to the recession in South Africa. We have a global economic crisis whose roots and causes have been much dissected in the last 9, 10, 11 months. There's been some of the most fascinating debates that we've seen in many, many years. Two of the leading financial newspapers, the Financial Times and the Economist, have been running this series of articles on the future of capitalism, articles on the future of economics itself, and it demonstrates that what the crisis has done, it has opened up a big debate about its causes and its consequences. The factors that led to the crisis, it's not just a single crisis, but a series of crises, complex, they're interrelated. You put two economists in the room and you'll get two opinions. And accordingly, what I've tried to do here is to borrow language that are broadly agreed language in South Africa to describe the causes of the crisis. The language that business, organized labor, government and community organizations agree to is that the factors that led to the crisis include gross imbalances and inequities in the global economic system, the impact of financialization of economies as the finance sector grew both in size and in importance in the aggregate shape of the modern global economy, ineffectual regulation in key economies, and poor business practices. This crisis was preceded by a number of smaller crises. You will recall the financial crisis in the United States, the savings and loan one that goes back many years, the East Asian financial crisis that reached its peak about 10, 11 years ago, the Latin American financial crisis thereafter, and the Russian crisis. But what we've seen now is the big crisis. It dramatically entered the consciousness of citizens across the world in September last year with a dramatic coverage on television when we saw the Wall Street meltdown. Triggered a number of proximate factors, but triggered most commentators would agree by the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, the indications of bankruptcy by what was at one point the world's biggest insurance company, and the AIG possible bankruptcy opened the question of what economists call systemic risk, where what happens to one company affects not just the shareholders and employees of that company, but potentially the system as a whole. Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae to, I guess, what one would call building societies in the old South African terms. The crash on Wall Street, where many, many, many billions of dollars of share value was wiped out in the space of weeks. And the official recession in the American economy. The impact shortly thereafter was dramatic and rapid across the world. Globalization, much as it is a system that's allowed significant opportunities for trade, for investment, for sharing of technology, also had a series of transmission belts that meant when there was a crisis in one country, it was more rapidly transmitted across the world than at any previous point. Just to illustrate, I mean, here is a graphic that was done that looked at the market capitalization of various banks. And the figures are for June 2007. So if you take Citigroup as an example, it's the example on the extreme left, well, from where you're sitting, on the extreme right on the slide there. The black represents the market capitalization of City Press in June 2007. The red represents the market cap in January 2009. Now that is an absolutely stunning graphic, and if it was one bank, it may be of great concern. If it is as many banks as you see here, it indicates the extent of the crisis across the financial sector globally. Consequences? The price of oil and many minerals fell sharply. Aggregate demand across the world dropped very substantially. Factories slowed down. Many closed. Credit to the real economy dried up across the world. Even interbank lending from one bank to the other, dried up. The ILO estimated early this year that the effect of the crisis would leave at least 50 million workers jobless. The effect on rural poverty was particularly severe. And of course, in the United States, many people lost homes and property as a result of the subprime crisis. Just to illustrate, by February this year, that is what the picture looked like on the price of platinum. That is what the price of oil looked like. Sharp, dramatic drop, reflecting markets factoring in a very, very significant slowdown in global economic activity. The demand for both the fuel that drives the economy and the raw materials is really an indicator of wider and deeper problems. Faced with an unusually severe contraction and crisis, the reaction by government was fairly swift. The American government intervened to an extent that overturned all the rules that had been applied over a number of years by governments, particularly by the U.S. government. They bailed out banks and an insurance company. There was an effective part nationalization of the finance sector as the state took equity, significant equity, in some of the banks. rescue of the auto sector, most dramatically, of course, General Motors. Massive stimulus package with both strong fiscal and monetary components to try to stop the recession. And unusually, a global coordination to pump liquidity into the markets. Colleagues will recall last year the unusual step when central bankers in a number of countries coordinated a rate cut on the same day as a signal to markets of the determination of government to bring liquidity into the system to try to avoid a complete crash of economies. China announced a stimulus package as its economy slowed down, a very, very significant stimulus package. European countries followed suit, but the crisis continued to spread in spite of these efforts, partly market sentiment, partly the underlying causes of the crisis had a series of multipliers. So as one part of the economy contracted, it had an impact on other parts of the economy, and partly because stimulus packages take time to work their way through the system. There was talk among some economists and others about South Africa being decoupled from the crisis, but the evidence from the real economy and from what we heard from businesses and from trade unions late last year already contradicted this. And based on very early indications that we were picking up, it was not yet coming through in the official data. South Africa began putting together a response to what we saw as then still a crisis largely located elsewhere, but whose impact and effects would be felt in the local economy. Then President Motsoaledi in December last year convened a meeting of business, labor, and community organizations. A task team was set up. By mid-December, the parties began to work on possible proposals and started to negotiate from the 19th of January to the 19th of February in 4 weeks. They put together a framework for South Africa's response to the global economic crisis. They developed the content, they agreed it, and the document set out some principles and very broad programs that then need more detailed work to be capable of implementation. Very briefly, colleagues, I'm going to take the committee through principles are in the framework. I'm sure some of this is well known by colleagues, that the first principle that was endorsed by the four constituents was that we need to do everything possible to ensure that those most vulnerable, the poor, the marginalized, are cushioned to the maximum extent possible from the crisis, that they don't pay the highest price of an economic crisis. That as we respond to the crisis and develop short-term measures and plans, we must strengthen the capacity of the economy to grow decent work in future, that there must be some connection between what we do in the short term and what we want to do in the long term. That we need to maintain high levels of investment, both public investment as well as private investment. That we need interventions that are timely, tailored, and targeted. And that we need a bold stimulus package. Those were the basic principles that were identified by the social partners in that four-week discussion. There are six main sections to the framework. They deal with maintaining high levels of investment, deploying macroeconomic tools to address the crisis, utilizing industrial and trade policies, seeing a key role for employment measures, recognizing that these must be complemented by social measures and addressing the global roots of the crisis as much as we deal with the national consequences of the crisis. The first of those programs is the one on public investment. And what it did, it set out a commitment that government will spend 787 billion rand on improving public infrastructure. These would cover housing construction, energy generation, hospitals and health clinics, schools and training colleges, railways, roads, dams, running water in both rural and urban areas. Now, if one look at the elements that that constitute the South African public investment program, you see immediately that they talk to both economic infrastructure and social infrastructure. They issues relevant to rural and urban development. They seek to fix the infrastructure for long-term growth, but focus the resources now during the recession. We agreed to maintain and, if possible, expedite the 787 billion rand in the context of the slowdown in the global economy. We agreed to identify additional resources, and we committed the development finance institutions to provide both technical and financial support for the public investment program. So what South Africa did was, instead of taking the view that in the context of a economic crisis we must cut back on the public investment proposals that had originally been developed, that had been put into the medium-term expenditure framework, we affirm that more than before, that is a vital response of government. And elsewhere in the world, what many governments did is, even where there were no pre-existing plans on infrastructure spending, in the face of the crisis, many governments across the world, China was one significant example, but there are many others, decided to upgrade their physical infrastructure in order to have an instrument to pump liquidity into markets. The second broad area that we dealt with was macroeconomic measures, and the document set out broad principles. It says that fiscal and monetary policy measures should be used countercyclically. That means over the course of the economic cycle, you know, during a broad cycle, you'd have both the boom in the economy and you'd have the contraction. And what countercyclical policies entail is that during a period of a contraction, the state steps in and ensures that you have basically resources, money, liquidity that pumps into the system, and you do this through all the tools available to the state. And by affirming a countercyclical policy, it really says that during a recession, fiscal policy needs to counteract the slowdown in the economy. The language we agreed in the framework is that we must use fiscal and monetary policy measures aggressively where required, is the word chosen, that they should be used in combination, that the solution doesn't lie in a reliance only on monetary policy or only on fiscal policy, but it's in that combination that we are able to achieve some of the goals, that they need to be aligned to each other, that the direction of fiscal policy and the direction of monetary policy should be in the same direction, and they should be complemented by trade and industrial policies. And what that really implied is that while these very broad instruments of fiscal and monetary policy have an absolutely key role to play not everything can be done purely through utilizing those tools, that they should be complemented by industrial and trade tools. We agree that business, labor, and community organizations should begin to engage with the Reserve Bank, and there were a number of issues that the constituents raised that they'd like to engage on: the interest rate regime, lowering the cost of capital, reducing the real interest rate gap between South Africa and other key trading partners. There was a recognition of the value of a competitive exchange rate to boost the economy. And the parties agreed that tax relief, particularly targeted to low-income South Africans, have a role to play. And there was a reference to the budget of February 2009 as providing a signal of government intention. We identified industrial and trade measures. It started with a agreement that industries affected by the crisis must be assisted, that South Africa had a key role to seek to avoid de-industrialization of the economy and to rebuild local industrial capacity that was lost in the initial period of the crisis. Small businesses were identified as vulnerable, and a list of both vulnerable and distressed sectors was identified in the framework, an initial list, and there was a broad definition of vulnerability that was developed to give some guidance to other sectors that may face problems. And the language that was used is that sectors with high employment and labor intensity, with large planned or actual job losses and company closures, would typically be described as vulnerable. There was a commitment that rescue packages should be developed, that a national jobs initiative must be launched, that for development finance institutions, their mandates and their support for the state sectors should be clarified, that we need to promote green jobs, local procurement, and combat illegal imports. Now, in identifying these different elements and more, I guess what we were trying to do is to say, in a situation of crisis, it's the range of different tools that government has available that needs to be sharpened. So if you take any of these, you take green jobs, normally a government would have an interest in promoting employment in a new industry or a new potential, logic, which is the environment, the green economy. In a period of economic crisis, you must seek to fast track that. If there are opportunities, see how you can work on tweaking your incentive structures, identifying opportunities, mobilizing the sentiment for changes to industrial processes that respond to the environment. Similarly with local procurement, while government would have a general commitment to local procurement in a crisis, there is a need to try to identify additional ways in which we can ensure that fiscal spending doesn't lead to large leakages. By leakages, economists refer to the tendency of the impact of your fiscal spending to be dissipated by a disproportionate tendency to import. And with combating illegal imports, similarly, there's a normal goal of government to ensure adherence to the import regime. But in circumstances of economic crisis, when there is a slowdown in economies, there's likely to be a greater pressure in ports of entry. When markets collapse, but this huge productive capacity still runs elsewhere in the world, there is great pressure for trade diversion, for moving to other markets. So if the American electronics market collapses and you've produced huge quantities of electronics, you've got to find a place to send it to. And so therefore, unless one can, in a crisis, strengthen your customs and excise function, you're likely to find a significant growth in imports and unfortunately also in the level of illegal imports. And so I'm wishing to share with the committee the logic of these different tools being used. Targeted trade measures. Again, the idea was that within the World Trade Organization rules, there are facilities available to countries. Sectors need to identify those. And then vitally maintain the flow of credit to the real economy. Maintain the flow of credit to the real economy. I'll return to that issue a little bit later. The next area was employment measures. We developed a number of private sector measures, a commitment by CEOs to avoid retrenchment of workers wherever possible and to explore alternatives, a restraint on excessive executive pay, a commitment by unions and employers to consider training layoffs as an alternative to retrenchment, and a commitment to maintain fair labor standards in responding to the crisis. In the public sector, government undertook to work hard on improving employment intake in the public sector in key delivery areas, such as health and education, crime, in fact all the areas that government has now identified as priority areas to ensure that it is properly staffed. There was a commitment to review outsourcing, to expand public works programs, and with the expansion of the public works programs, to look at scaling up the program, increasing the duration of contracts, combining it with training, and bringing in community partners. Some of this entailed a consideration that an expanded public works program, if efficiently administered, may well require additional government funding. And in February, government committed that if, in fact, we could ensure efficient delivery of the expanded public works program, more resources would be mobilized for it. On social measures, there was a commitment to social plans by business and labor at sector and plant level, working to enhance unemployment insurance benefits, seeking to moderate food prices through a combination of means, competition measures, special programs, and emergency food relief. Government affirmed the commitment to increase the child grant progressively to age 18 over a number of years, and to strengthen co-ops as a response to the crisis. And in respect of cooperatives, there are both employment and services components to it. The cooperatives could be helpful in absorbing people into employment, but they may also be able to provide services in poor communities where the consequence of the crisis may well be the failure by traditional means, by traditional methods of service. So, as an example, if you find that in a particular locality a company closes, small rural district, is there scope, is there space for cooperatives to fill that space? Global coordination, recognize deep weaknesses in governance of globalization, the need to develop global responses with other countries, review the global financial and social architecture, and support prudent regulation of South African capital markets and the retention of capital control. Now, this is quite a significant thing to highlight, because this is the one component we haven't spoken much of. I didn't refer much to this in the statement to the House last week. But in the framework, it's a recognition that we needed to do some immediate things, but there are also systemic challenges that underlie our response. And that section of the framework deals with it quite substantially. But not only does it identify some global challenges, it also identifies policy challenges in South Africa. And we had support by business, labor, community, and of course government, for the view that you needed prudent regulation of South African capital markets and a retention of capital controls. After a long period when there was a debate about capital controls, this crisis showed the value of some capacity to manage the outflow of, in our case, domestic capital. And so many developing countries were particularly vulnerable during the crisis because portfolio capital fled what they regarded as risky domains. And where domestic capital followed them, it led to very, very substantial crises, financial crises for those economies. We agreed to advocate measures to enhance financial market stability and penalize predatory and risky behavior. And there were a number of ideas there, in particular to consider measures to discourage short-term speculative investment. And I was interested to see that the lead story today in the London Financial Times deal with exactly this dimension. We agreed in the framework to address issues of global macroeconomic imbalances and proposed that development assistance to developing countries should not be scaled down. On the institutional front, we agreed that when South Africa takes part in the G20, the group of 20 industrial countries that had originally been convened in Washington and later in London, that we need to put up proposals to deal with the systemic problems in the global economy, and that we needed to ensure strong involvement by trade unions, business organizations, and community organizations in helping to shape government thinking. In respect of the World Trade Organization, we agreed to promote a developmental agenda that supports employment, vulnerable sectors, decent work, and policy space for South Africa. On the IMF and World Bank, we agreed that we should put forward proposals to review their mandate, and in particular their governance, to ensure that the weight of developing countries in the governance structures of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank be increased, and that we need to strengthen the International Labour Organization so that global governance is not only about financial governance but also social governance, bringing the two elements together that would constitute a more sustainable form of global economic cooperation. Now, shortly after the framework was agreed, the country went into selection mode. And a short while thereafter, the elections were held. President Zuma was elected. And in his State of the Nation address, he set out the broad vision of government. The creation of decent work will be at the center of our economic policy, influence investment attraction and job creation initiatives, and we have to forge it to promote a more inclusive economy. And critically, the President endorsed the framework agreement as the basis of government's response to the economic challenges. So that was the key signal that we will now have full backing for the framework by the new administration. I turn briefly, colleagues, to the impact on South Africa. The full impact on South Africa was only reflected in our economic data from May. Until April, there was still a debate where some economists argued that South Africa would escape relatively unscathed from the global economic crisis. But by May, when the economic data came in that showed that the country had now had a number of successive quarters of economic contraction, there was consensus that this was going to be a tough period ahead. I have shared in the House the details of the exports of minerals that dropped, the dramatic slowdown in economic growth, manufacturing sector shrinking by about 20%, the job losses, and in particular the fact that job losses have multiplier effects on sales and consumption, which in turn lead to further contraction. The rand in the early part of the crisis performed poorly against the dollar, then rose rapidly again, so we saw again rand volatility. Credit became more difficult to obtain, and our current account balance of payment deficit pressures continued. We had a number of employment consequences. The quarterly employment survey of Stats SA shows 179,000 job losses in the first 3 months of the year. The labor force survey recorded 267,000 job losses in the second 3 months of the year. And very importantly, it also pointed to an additional 300,000 people who were discouraged work seekers. Now, by the way, these are two different surveys, both administered by Stats SA, but using slightly different methods. And they both point to the same direction, big job losses, and the same magnitude. So technically, one can't just add the one to the other. Evidence from businesses and from unions showed us the same trend. So we had a extensive convergence of official data, GDP, output, employment, liquidations, sales, anecdotal evidence from the partners in the economy, all that pointed to a bleak picture. And that's just an illustration of the rand dollar volatility. That shows you the figures for GDP, the quarterly GDP figures seasonally adjusted. And the red there is manufacturing. We had three quarters. It's not four. It's a little gremlin that's kept. So you should say three. If you don't mind changing your slide. Three quarters of declining GDP. Taking into account sector size, the most significant losses by far was in manufacturing. And manufacturing levels are now back to where they were in 2004. Now, if this trend continues for a long enough period, if we look at June, it's extremely worrying. The big question is whether this continues over a sufficient period. If it does, then the serious threat of deindustrialization sets in. We've had contractions in other sectors as mining. And here's just a little graph to show you the index of physical volume of production in manufacturing. And that's a breakdown of a few subsectors. The blue, which is the most volatile in this period, is the motor vehicles and transport equipment sector. The red is basic metals, metal products and machinery. And the yellow is textiles, clothing, leather and footwear. Now, the response by South Africa, just to recap, in February we concluded the broad brush framework agreement. In March we commenced discussion on its implementation. By April we took some of the reflections out of our domestic discussion to London for the G20 meeting, and there was of course the elections where there was some discussion and debate between political parties on responses. In May, a new cabinet was constituted by the newly elected president. A cabinet lehotla was held with provinces towards the end of May, and the economic data confirmed the country was officially in a recession. In June, the president gave his State of the Nation address, and the framework was confirmed as the basis of government's response. In July, we convened a meeting of the leadership of business community as well as the labor movement and community organizations, and they agreed to a set of priority measures that we must fast track our work. And in August we announced six key measures flowing from those discussions. The first of that was the training layoff. The concept, it's an extended training period as an alternative to retrenchment. Funding, we would place 2.4 billion rand in the National Jobs Fund, with that money drawn equally between the Unemployment Insurance Fund reserves and the National Skills Fund. It's available to workers earning up to 180,000 rand per annum. Its critical element is a training allowance of 50% of the basic salary, up to 6,239 rand per month. And the employers who participate in this scheme will be required to pay a basic social package which would cover funeral costs, death and disability of workers. The period is 3 months, and there's some flexibility on the structure. Can either be a full layoff or it can be a partial layoff in the form of short time. The training that is intended to be undertaken is left to sectors and workplaces to determine, but we've given three guidelines. Company usable skills, generic skills like communication skills, but also an opportunity to address the vast challenges of literacy and numeracy. And finally, information and communication technology skills. The trigger is a workplace agreement between workers and their employer. We've made the services of the CCMA available, and 250 commissioners have been trained now, ready to, as soon as the scheme is switched on, to commence with generating these agreements between business and labor. On CETAs, their role would be to identify the training courses out of the training that they have to date developed, and to be responsible for the funding conduit work to get the money from the National Jobs Fund to the individual companies. The key that we're trying to do here is not establish new institutions as far as possible, because we need rapid response. We must be able to get this up and running within weeks rather than within the normal speed that it would take if we had to design fresh and new delivery instruments. The Department of Labor has a role in coordinating and developing the implementation guidelines, and there are other partners. Businesses are key, as a union. The Economic Development Department and the DTI will play some support role in it. And that constitutes the one key area of the framework that we have been able to conclude. On customs fraud, very briefly, illegal imports and customs fraud led to many thousands of job losses. SARS has now stepped up its action. More resources have been made available to SARS, and actions have been taken against companies engaging in a range of illegal practices. We made available in the National Assembly examples from just one sector of SARS's increased action against illegality, and there you have some instances of the work SARS is now undertaking. The third program is IDC Support the Industrial Development Corporation. Has made 6 billion rand available over 2 years to companies in distress due to recession. This will take the form of both credit and working capital. 49 funding applications are in the pipeline, and as we reported at the National Assembly since the 1st of April, 11 financing applications totaling 743 million rand has been approved. That's been complemented by work that we've done in the distress sector. Packages have been developed now for three broad sectors: automotive, clothing and textiles, and capital equipment, transport equipment, and metal fabrication. A number of measures have been identified to address immediate problems, and the Department of Trade and Industry issued a statement last night identifying and setting out the detail of those measures. Support for the auto industry was linked to conditionalities on jobs, affordability, environmental issues, and modest pay and dividends. This increased incentives for the capital equipment sector. And on clothing and textiles, there is a possible alternative incentive scheme that has been placed on the table and that has now been discussed over a number of weeks with the social partners. The implementation of the distress sector package is the responsibility of the DTI and its agencies. Food prices and competition action became a key focus over the last number of months since the framework, and the Competition Commission has stepped up action against companies colluding or taking part in anti-competitive action. They focus on 7 parts of the food supply chain: bread, milling, dairy, poultry, fertilizers, fats and oil, and supermarkets. And the intention here is to ensure that we can bring relief to consumers who are particularly hard hit in a period of recession. Debt management, the goal has been to address pressure on over-indebted consumers. The National Debt Mediation Association, which is a business venture, has done some work. They've developed rules, standards, and processes to address debt restructuring. Going forward, colleagues, a key part of what we now need to do is to implement the 6 measures effectively, to develop a new set of areas from the framework agreement, to progress policy discussions on the shape of a new global economic and social architecture. South Africa is a participant in a number of global forums, and as we saw, we were significantly affected by some of the challenges in global governance, and we have a contribution to make in the constructive dialogue that countries are now having about the global governance. There are some new issues that we're working on. Expanded public works programs to see how can we identify the problems and how can we maximize the opportunities. On public infrastructure, is to look at the 787 billion rand. It's a very, very significant investment by South Africa, and we need to ensure that in the design of the different infrastructure programs, we maximize the local impact and particularly the employment impact. We wish to work on local procurement to see in particular how state spending can be of greater support to local industry. We're identifying some conditionalities that we're talking to business, labor, communities on, which would apply when government makes funding available as part of rescue packages. We want to highlight green jobs as an area that must be fast-tracked. We recognize that we must have appropriate relief for those most vulnerable, for women, for people in the informal economy, and we don't believe we've made enough progress on that, so we want to work harder on that. And we wish to continue the engagement with the banking sector on the flow of credit, both to the real economy as well as to households. For the future, there are much debate at the moment globally on whether we have signs of recovery. The signs as they are tentative. Many economists are concerned that much of the growth that is taking place elsewhere in the world is principally off the large stimulus packages, and the question is whether that is sustainable if and when the stimulus packages are reduced or discontinued. Can growth sustain itself? Work done on some of the past financial crises have shown that employment recovery normally lag economic recovery. So we are likely to see jobs being lost globally for longer than the period of the official global recession. And that means that unless there are very strong measures taken by governments in labor markets to try to maintain employment, the impact of that unemployment would not only be socially very, very serious and damaging, but can slow down the economic recovery itself. The crisis has challenged economic orthodoxies. People are talking and debating more openly now what kind of financial market regulation we need, what kind of architecture we require for a more sustainable model of global economic cooperation. Out of the G20 process, there's the beginning of discussion on global financial regulation. You would have seen the steps that countries have now taken in, for example, closing tax havens and beginning to put together forums and institutions that can help to develop globally coordinated regulation for the financial sector. Critical, though, is the global imbalances have not yet been resolved. China continues to have a significant surplus. The United States continues to have a significant deficit. Aside from the deficits and surpluses on the current account, we've had big budget deficits, very low interest rates globally. Here is just an extract from this week's Economist magazine. One of the columns you will see is the budget balance as a percentage of GDP. And unusually, if you look at that, it's the third last column. You see the number of countries that are now in deficit. count the number of minuses. You can also see the extent of the deficit. Look at the United States, 13.7%. Now, of course, these are estimates. There are different figures used that different economists use, but they're broadly within the range of these kind of figures. And it shows not only how severe the crisis has been in those economies with the impact on the reduced tax collection, but they also show the increased spending by governments to try to combat the economic slowdown. By way of some conclusions, this is a new experience for the democracy dealing with a deep economic contraction. Not a short-term problem, not something that will only be with us for 3 months or 6 months, because the employment challenge is certainly going to be taking a while to address. What the president has indicated is that government has the resolve to act to protect jobs, to protect the economy, and to protect our people. That we recognize we must address both immediate as well as systemic issues. Most of our focus now has gone on the immediate issues, but the systemic issues are not unimportant. And the G20 is one forum, the United Nations is the other forum, where there is a spirited discussion on the shape of a post-crisis world. As government, we wish to build partnerships to confront the challenge. We want to work strongly with business organizations and the business community, as well as organized labor and community organizations. And we see an absolutely vital role for Parliament as a representative of the South African people. And I would commit that we, as government, and certainly my ministry, would regularly report to Parliament, including through statements to the House, through the work of this committee, that we look forward to the portfolio committee advising and clarifying its role in ensuring accountability, that we do what we say we will do. There's an important role that Parliament could play in popularizing the framework agreement itself. And the Chair has raised with me the possibility of public hearings that the committee may wish to hold on the impact of the recession and the success of the measures that government is announcing. And so, Chairperson, I conclude my discussion by my presentation by saying that I've taken a significant amount of time in the hope that it is an investment in all the future meetings where we could take the framework itself as read and we would be reporting on progress we are making. It is new. We're learning how to do things as we're proceeding, as are all countries across the world. No one country has all the answers. This is the last time that the global economy had a contraction this severe was in the Great Depression. And so in our generation, in living memory, we've not seen a fall as sharp as this. And what is of particular concern is that some of the underlying causes of this have not been adequately addressed. So the shape of the recovery is very uncertain. Thank you very much, Jefferson.
Thank you very much, Minister. And I want to say to you that I think it is for the first time that, you know, we get such a very, very detailed briefing wherein all of us are able to understand. I think I've been to various committees and chairs. And it's for the first time that I'm able really to understand clearly what is happening in as far as this crisis is concerned. Thank you very much for giving yourself time to prepare this particular presentation. It is indeed helpful. Let me take this opportunity to welcome the chair of the Trade and Industry Committee. Thank you very much, Comrade Fox, for joining us. I know you were busy with other, in other committees, and thanks for taking time to be with us also. And all other members who joined us afterwards, we have already commenced with our meeting. Colleagues, we know that we've committed to end this meeting at 12:30, mainly because it's Friday and many of you will be heading to the airport. We will stick to that. I think the minister has given us enough time to engage until that time. Please, I want to plead with you to really be within this particular presentation so that we can save time and then so that we can also allow other members to ask questions. Okay, obviously there are members that I'm not yet familiar with their names, but the secretary will help me here. I will start on, I thought of the someone on my right hand side, so that we are able to start there. Member Ntuli, Member Mabaso, Member Sokesi, Member Wang. Yes, Member Kobasa. That's the first round. The next round is Member Khrele, Member Ngonyama, Member Rabi, Member Van der Westhaven. Oh, Madam, you missed your turn. This part. You will go in the second round, then you'll be the last in the second round. Thank you. In that order, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. And we would like to thank the minister for the comprehensive presentation. We would like to echo your words, Chairperson. That was a good presentation. In the upfront, Chairperson, I would like to say it seems as if we'll be able to differ with the framework which the minister has put forward. I think it's we as the committee will be able to support the minister and will be able to work with the minister, so that because it's not for the minister alone, but it's for all of us. Particularly, Minister, I would like us to say, if we can follow the practice of China, let's say particularly when it comes to auto manufacturers, if we can avoid the deindustrialization. If we can be able to put some money there to those companies, auto industry, and the other thing is that I'm not sure whether it is your terrain, but if we have to look at this high vacancy rate in the public service sector. If we can be able to fill all these positions to support the improvement of employment intake, particularly in the key positions in the public service sector, because I believe there are so many, about 40% vacancy rate there. Why can't we? I think it's a right opportunity at this time just to do that, to fill all those vacancies so that we can be able to move forward. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Colleague Chair. I'm echoing the width of the whip in thanking the minister. But I also think it, when we follow the illustration, it shows that it is an opportunity of all the stakeholders in the economy to come together, you know, faced with the challenge, so that it's not a challenge that's facing government alone, but it becomes a challenge facing labor, government, community-based organizations, civil society, so that it's a challenge. But the spirit that I get from the input is that there are broad consultations, and that augurs well for facing a challenge of this nature. And the other part is that where government intervenes in looking after the plight of the poor, I also note that it does so without taking away the pride of people, you know, because if you inject funds into the economy in such a manner that the recipients of such funds are earning those funds, it's a better way of doing things than if people were receiving assistance which is not connected to work. And in saying this, I also note the minister having touched on areas like cooperatives, where for cooperatives to take off and be sustainable, it means that government intervention is needed. But what is good is that such cooperatives can themselves stand on their feet, and government can later disengage and assist new ones. Thanks, Colleague Chair.
Thank you, Member Mavaso. Followed by Member Budip. Can you have your mic on?
Oh, thank you. On the issue of rescuing companies in distress in order to seek jobs, I think the government doesn't have money. It takes money from us taxpayers. And having said this, I just want to quote something I saw on ETV Monday or Tuesday, whereby police were raiding businesses owned by some people from Pakistan, Bangladesh, Limpsey, and for example. I have a problem with this, but I can't fix it.
May we request that those who have cell phones now to switch them off?
Yes, close it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the thing. One would like to see the police, as they do their raid, to be accompanied by officials from SARS. Yeah, they also check if these people are paying tax. And they're actually checking if their papers are legitimate. But I think it will be more important if they also check if these people are paying tax. And also to monitor, we don't know how, but sure, we have some people in government with the expertise to do that kind of job. Also to check if they do invest their money in our banks, because there is information that we haven't researched to verify that these people who are doing business in our country do not invest their money in our banks. It therefore defeats, you know, the programs of economic growth in our country. And again, the labor broken system also defeats the important intention of government to save jobs. I'm not opening a debate on that. There was a public hearing on this. Maybe at some stage the Department of Labor will update us on the development. Thank you.
Thank you, Member. This is very important.
Thank you, Chairperson. Firstly, I'd like to thank you for the Minister, your wonderful presentation. Also very deeply for the all the detail. I have the two questions will be gathered from the Minister, if you can give me the more detail. Regarding for your presentation, 34 and 35 is the training layoff. I want to know is how we can get this figure for the if the workers can earn for the $180,000 per annum. I don't know how can get this figure? Because the company, two retrenchment for their workers only for 3 months for layoff. Also from the your presentation, they offer she can only get for the allowance 50% of the salary, only $6,239 per month. But from my information is if a company wants retrenchment for workers, always from the low income is the workers, because it's high level is the income is the people, it's high technology. The company even for the global restriction, they want to lost the order, but they still can't keep these low income people in the company inside. So if from this training layoff, I like to know is more detail. How can get this $180,000 and $6,200 per month? And the big issue, I just thinking this training by this company negotiation with the union, pass to the CCM, make agreement. I think it's if the true to the union side, I know it's the minister, the curious, you have a lot of experience from the union. A negotiation with must pass to the CCMA, because it is how to identify. If so, say example, my company, I want a treatment for about 20 people go to the training for the layoff, because this one is among the is 6,900, about the plus minus 6,900 for the 20 workers for the by company. Some big company not only 20, maybe it's 150, 200. But this one negotiating with the union side, the union say no, we need more, because retreatment for the my member is the too many is out of the job. So if due to the CCM they want to come to the our layoff, this budget the 2.4 billion. I find that it's quite a lot of issue in the inside for the negotiator and the make agreement. So I just for my concern. Yeah. And the second question is due to the IBC support. From the your presentation is 6 billion already allocated for the IBC over 2 years. But at the moment, the 49 funding already available in the pipeline is, I think, I got your information already approved for 3.3 billion. So only 2.7 billion is after 2 years will be allocated. Too many cases, but in future potential, these people need support from the IDC side. Also, you already say it's 1st April is 740 million is approved. Then the special is my question is the auto industry. Because the auto industry is for the due to the our last few days workshop and trade industry seminar, this professor coming indicates to us this the auto industry get a subsidy 48 billion from the our government side, but for the world competition in future after 5 years, China is export for the auto car is the top one in the world. So how we can competition from our local auto industry, still get a subsidy from the big amount from the government side? Because from the auto industry, if subsidy get the 48 billion, then what is the clothing and textile? Because from clothing and textile industry, for my information, very difficult get the support from the IDC. Because they're not a big business in this industry side for the individual. Every company, textile company, not a big among the like the auto industry. So they want to get a full support from IDC. I think it's the minister, maybe you know, it's very difficult. So from your presentation, you say manufacturer is activity now back to the level of 2004. These are more concerns, more worries. Now it's back to 2004. So how from your new department can approve for the improving for this crisis? Thank you.
Mr. Huang, thank you for Member Kwabasi.
Chairperson, thank you. Honorable Minister, I do want to say that this presents hope for our people. And the task that lies ahead for all of us is how do we turn this hope into reality. Two questions, Chairperson. The first is, in the most recent days, we've heard that the medical aid scheme is under very serious distress, to the extent that many of them are likely to collapse and therefore cause a very serious strain on the healthcare system in the country. On slide 14, Minister, you make mention of the in the public investment area of infrastructure on hospitals and health clinics. I do want to ask the Minister if you are also considering assisting the medical aid scheme in the way of you know responding in the same way you are doing with the distressed companies. Obviously, it might be difficult to just pump money into the medical aid scheme, but is there some thinking towards that direction? Just in addition to the infrastructure on hospitals and clinics. Secondly, Chairperson, on slide 14, on the issue of the distressed sectors, one academic about a week or two ago suggested that part of the reason why some of the companies are in distress is that they, whilst they have sophisticated technology, they are not, however, using this sophisticated technology in their companies efficiently. And therefore, this academic was suggesting that before you bring relief to these distressed companies, you might have to check whether they are efficiently being run. But also, Chairperson, I do think that raises also, you know, the question of the already recognized weaknesses in terms of skills development, and therefore that may present a further case for the reskilling of these workers that are facing retrenchment. Your comment on that, Minister. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Member Kovusa. I'm coming this side, Member Hill.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a very detailed presentation and a very good response, but I mean, the thought that comes to mind is that this is a very good short-term response, and I think that it's certainly necessary at this stage. I mean, I think as Paul Krugman says, we all are Keynesians at the moment, and it's certainly a Keynesian approach. But, you know, my kind of concern, though, is that if we're dealing with a crisis, not just a kind of downswing in a business cycle, and that we're going to probably emerge with a very different world at the end of this, and a world that's probably going to be put on a different kind of development path. And are we sufficiently actually looking at what kind of a world that's going to be so that we can position South Africa now during this crisis time to take advantage of the world going forward? And when I say that, I have a number of factors which I'd just like your opinion on to consider going forward. I mean, the first one is to what extent is resource constraints proving a physical limit to global economic growth? And in particular, to what extent is peak oil proving to be a kind of global trip switch for the economy? And because a lot of economists are in fact saying that it was peak oil and the rise of the oil price to $150 a barrel, which was the kind of final straw that led to this crisis then coming in. And to what extent is that going to happen again when recovery starts to go? And to what extent do we then plan for a response to that? The other one is, to what extent is economic power shifting around the globe? I mean, to what extent is it shifting away from Europe and America and towards the East, and how do we then position ourselves in terms of that? And then also, to what extent are we going to see a change in the global economic ideology? I mean, certainly what I'm picking up is the kind of complete death of the Washington consensus. And in fact, not only is it the complete death, but people are asking some very critical questions as to how it's led to the deindustrialization of the developing world. And so are we seeing a major shift in the kind of global economic ideology, where things such as inequality are already addressed on a global scale and on a national scale, and also the reemergence, obviously, of industrial policy in that? And then just lastly, are we also not witnessing one of the great technological revolutions at the moment? And in fact, I look at Carletta Perez's work on this, and she says that this whole model that we see now corresponds with the five technological revolutions that have taken place in the world, where you get this exuberance from the financial speculators, you get this bubble economy emerging at the growth of new technological infrastructure. They get out ahead, the whole thing explodes, then global regulations come in place, then we start to see the kind of creative destruction of the old order, and the new technological revolution starts to embed itself in that society. And are we looking at that sufficiently enough so that we can then reposition South Africa now to be able to take advantage of this next technological revolution? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Minister. Maybe moving and starting from the general to the particular, I want to say that with regard to the political environment in the country, I think it is very, very important for us to take that one very seriously, because it's a soft issue and which actually determines a number of things that may impact on the multiply effect that you've referred to. And now I'm referring in particular to the and the activities like the defense and the sort of strike that we had, and which definitely will impact on the environment, political environment, which determines attractiveness of our country. That is one. The second issue, Chair, is the, I think that you've made a point in the slide, I think slide number 12, both stimulus package. Both stimulus package and also requires and a bold management package. And the the presentation comes across very well on a number of areas, but when it comes to the management of this package, and my own observation and judgment, it is weak. The second issue is on coordination, and it does actually refer to coordination, and but it's not decisive and strong enough. Mind, if we talk about and a package of this nature, and it needs extraordinary, because it's an extraordinary plan, which needs extraordinary discipline. And I do believe that that's an area that we have to look at. The other issue is on the skills. Yes, we do refer to the retraining and as an alternative to retrenchment, but the judgment and observation and identification of the skills that are necessary is still left and to the business and the labor. I believe that we have to and put up a team, and that would be my proposal, that I was trying to look where are we identifying which of the skills that are necessary to anchor our economy during these very, very difficult times. And therefore, I believe that maybe there's a necessity for us to actually look at that as South Africa. And we do need some kind of an expert to look at what are the key skills that are necessary to anchor this economy during this difficult time. And perhaps to also and refer to the question of the time frames, and we are not taken through and on the time frames exactly on various aspects or phases of this package. Because you see, when we deal with a project of this nature, I believe that it cannot be just a general package. It has to be like a project, and therefore with different phases to it, so that we can be able to manage it and monitor it and properly, all of us. And That takes me to the last point, perhaps, and that is the point of national consensus. And I believe, and Minister, with all the efforts that you've actually with regard to consultation, if we don't move beyond and government, labor, and business, and look at South Africans in general, and yes, we do refer to this, but in terms of and the various activities or maybe and the consultations that we've embarked on, and we have very, very strong intellectuals in South Africa. By the way, if we draw from history, Keynes himself emerged during the Great Depression as an intellectual, and he became a scholar that assisted the world to emerge out of the that kind of depression. And I do believe that we may actually come up with other Keynes that can emerge even during this depression, if we can widen up our net much stronger and to actually take everybody on board. And the last one, Chair, is regional integration and WTO development agenda. And I fully agree that we have to focus on that on development agenda. But to what extent are we going to be able to win that battle? And the regional integration, there's very little, and especially relating to the EPAS, because these economic partnership agreements are definitely going to impact and on the economy of the region. And to what extent are we able to tilt the balance in favor of the region? Chair, I want to say thank you very much for this presentation. It's a very, very thoroughgoing presentation, but we have to interact with it and much more strongly, so that because I believe this is a package for the country, and the government and the department have to be open about it, so that all and the various and the stakeholders are able to make impact with it if we're going to extricate ourselves from the challenge.
Thank you, Member Konyama. Member
Rame. Madam Chair, thank you very much. Thank you, Minister. In your very impressive submission, you mentioned that it's important to lower the cost of capital, that we also have to maintain the flow of credit to the real economy. And you also said something that there is ongoing discussions with the banking sector. Madam Chair, I heard a leading South African businessman, he's the chairman of a company listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, say that 90% of all applications to banks are being turned down at the moment. Now, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask the Minister, is government considering to amend or relax the National Credit Act? Because I couldn't agree with him more. I think credit is essential for an economy to grow. And I think at the moment our credit regulations tend to impede growth. I'd like to have his views on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Member Rabi. Although I wouldn't have really liked us to go, the areas that you are mentioning specifically are areas that the Minister indicated that they're still working on at the discussions level, at the testing level. Yes. So the Minister might give his own opinion and not the opinion of the team. I think you'll appreciate that. But I thought maybe we'll just focus on those that have been concluded already, because that's the final area of the team. Thank you very much. The last person noted, I nearly forgot to Member van der Westhuizen, and then Member Vanamela. I had completely forgotten. Sorry about you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Honourable Minister. I would like to know, to what extent has the government been successful in obtaining the support of the labour unions in this fight to protect jobs and to curb unemployment? And I'm asking this specifically in the light of what I have experienced has been excessive increases in salaries, especially in some public sectors like the local government sector and some state corporations. Because as I understand it, the moment people get more than the inflation rate or the predicted inflation rate in terms of salary increases, it knocks on to other people and it makes their life more miserable and it puts other people out of jobs. And what we've seen is that some local governments have really increased rates and taxes by percentages that far exceed the inflation rate, which also, into my understanding, is really flying against this whole thing of trying to curb costs and to make life easier for especially the more vulnerable, who are often those that are not protected by unions. So to what extent have you been successful in obtaining the support of the unions?
Thanks, Mr. President. Member Manamela.
Thank you very much. I think the first thing that I want to raise is the fact that we had a period wherein there was 6% on average growth on a year-to-year basis, and it is agreed that it was a jobless growth, meaning that there were not a lot of jobs that are being created. But over and above that, we also have a serious decline in real incomes, as it relates to worker wages. And I think that's a reality. Over a protracted period of time, they may have been increasing in money terms, but in relation to the real economy, the ability of workers to be able to afford basic needs, that has been dealt a serious blow over a particular period of time. And I think that explains why, partly explains why, the economic crisis, that you had a wage stagnation over a period of time, and that part of the things that we really need to be talking about is the whole issue of real wages. And I think that's why there's been all of this, demonstrations on the part of trade unions, basically demanding that, share of wages needs to be to increase. So I think it's a reality that we need to start dealing with, and I think it's one of the things that we may need to factor into the discussions and negotiations at an ad-like level. So to dismiss trade union action as being opportunistic, as being unrealistic, as not taking into consideration the attracting foreign investment and all of those things, I think that is quite simplistic without necessarily looking at the share of worker wages into the economy. So that's the one part. And I know that, for instance, the reason why we may be raising the actions by members of the South African National Defense Force could precisely be, I think, specifically the political implications for the country, negativity, South Africa is not stable, and all of that. But we also cannot explain the fact that some of them are earning 1,800 rand. Of course, let's deal with the fact that they are busting out, they are being violent in their demonstrations. That's wrong. But I think that in the same way, we need to say that it's unexplainable that members of SANDF are earning 1,800 rand, and even more embarrassing is the fact that some of their wages or a share of their wages is being concentrated into employment agents. I think that is a serious problem that we need to openly speak about with the same energy that we speak around condemning their violence. So that's the first. The second thing is that they need to be much more stringent. I've seen the some of the conditions that have been advanced in terms of funding the private sector, the stimulus package, and a lot of progress that has been done. But over and above those conditions, I think that we need commitments not only in terms of excessive executive space, which is why we're in this problem in the first place, but also in terms of dividends to shareholders of companies that are in distress and that are receiving public money to save them. But even beyond that, we need to seriously start looking at considering workers' cooperatives taking over some of the companies that are in distress and may seem not to be coming out of that particular distress. So government intervention as part of the stimulus package should be to finance worker cooperatives, which you know, would obviously mean that you expand you know, the workers' share into the economy, and especially because it would be financing all of those things with public money, you know, so we really need to strongly consider the cooperative aspect of it as part of the you know, stimulus package, and the fact that we'll be stimulating you know, the economy much more directly, I mean, on the part of consumers. The other factor that I wanted to raise is around the social you know, stimulus package. Agree with increasing the age of the grant to 18 years, and I think that has been one of the things that you know, should have happened ideally a long time ago. But some of the things that we strongly want to recommend is serious investment into you know, sustainable programs, socio-economic programs, into health facilities, you know, health services in the public sector. It may not necessarily be directly within the private sector health or with medical aid, but with improving the public health service, improving the education system, making sure that we've got more and more you know, people having access to education, improving the housing and human settlement conditions, so meaning that directly investing into local government to build houses. And I think the offspins are quite are going to be quite positive. You you know, making a long term impact you know, into the lives of our people. ESCOM suggests that they are likely to ask NESA to increase the cost of electricity, and I think that part of the intervention needs to go into that. Lots of households are in distress. We're just imagining from a more than 25% you know, increase of electricity. I think that part of the things we really need to be looking at as part of the intervention is electricity. There has to be an end to some of, I mean, to the service delivery strikes that are taking place, which indirectly are also as a result of, you know, the economic crisis. A period of cutting on social expenditure has led into some of the mess that, you know, we find ourselves in. And just finally, I think there was a good point raised earlier on about the vacancies in the public sector. Close to, you know, the 30% or whatever figure there is. I think that we really need to be looking at filling in those vacancies in the public sector. The options obviously would be a strong public sector, quality service delivery, and all of those things, but also stimulating the economy by creating jobs in that area. They could be amounting to more than 500,000. You know, some would say it's 100,000 of, I mean, there are 100,000 vacancies in local government alone. What's more about vacancies in provincial and national government? So I think that we really and strongly need to you know, look into encouraging government to fill in those vacancies. In that way, we are widening the tax base and increasing, and obviously ultimately increasing the fiscal, but you also will have more people participating in the economy. It means more people will go to banks looking for mortgages, more people will go to banks, I mean, to into the auto industry wanting to buy cars and all of those things. So I think that, you know, over and above saving the private sector, let's save households, let's save workers, and that in a way would have long-term sustainable effects. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Member Manamela. Minister, I think these are the initial questions. I hope that there won't be any other questions after this. You have a follow-up question? Okay, because of one. I'll give you that opportunity to do so.
No, Chair.
Mainly because I can see that the house is getting depleted.
One other observation, Madam Chair and Minister, is the lack of emphasis on agriculture. and as a very, very important industry for food security during times like this. If we deal with poverty, there's very little that is said about injection on agriculture. The question of the co-ops, I do appreciate the fact that we refer to this. The little experience that I have about co-ops, yes, I know the co-ops that were there within the South African context before 1994. But successful, democratic, participatory co-ops, there are few in the world. It's Mondragon that I can remember, experience of Spain. I'm saying that as we get into that, during this time, we'll be very, very vigilant and very cautious in being adventurous at this stage. Yes, we need to promote co-ops, but we have to do so, and in a manner in that will not actually lend us into and the unnecessary quagmire.
Okay. Thank you, Minister. Let me give you this opportunity. I'll actually say something after you have a question.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I've counted 10 speakers who spoke a range of very interesting and thought-provoking questions, not all of which I'll be able to deal with adequately here, but I'm going to try to at least take one or two out of each contribution. The Honourable Ntuli's point that he raised around the high vacancy rate in the public sector that's also raised by the Honourable Manamela, I would simply make the point that for government there are two significant advantages to us finding ways of filling all our vacancies and doing so rapidly. The one is the traditional one, the one that was a key issue in the political mandate, and that is to improve service delivery. But the second part is in a recession, public sector employment is an absolutely critical counter-cyclical measure. And if we fail to utilize the space that we have, we are not going to be able to have the macro effect on the economy that is one key goal of government. So we are now working on this. It's a challenge. And we hope we would be able to report more positively in future meetings on this. The Honourable Ntuli's question around the auto sector, particularly difficult challenge we face is that the auto sector is in some degree of crisis in many parts of the world. And we are particularly concerned to ensure that at the end of the economic crisis, at the end of the recession, South Africa must not have dismantled its productive capacity in manufacturing. A recession is literally a huge deficit between demand and supply. You have a collapse of aggregate demand. And when you have all the factories and workplaces of the world competing in a recession, generally speaking, the intention of each company is to survive, and it recognizes that it can survive by getting its competitors out of business. The auto sector, where there's been overproduction even preceding the crisis, the challenge we're going to face is what decisions do the head offices of the big automakers make? When you are based in Germany and you have overproduction in your own global supply chain, which factories do you close? Those in South Africa or those in Germany? And what do you do when you're also the recipient of government support in your host country. And that government support is tied to supporting employment in that country. So if we're not cautious, there is every prospect that there can be damaging deindustrialization at the end of this recession. So therefore, a lot of our work is going now into appropriate responses in the sphere sectors. As more of the details are firmed up, the Minister of Trade and Industry will make the necessary announcements. But we've all said to him that we support him very strongly. This is a key area of work. And the auto sector, I mean, if one looks at the figures I've put on here previously, you saw the very, very significant loss of manufacturing production in South Africa in what is a period of probably 12 months. Let's just go to the physical volume of production. You see a peak there in 2008. You see the sharp decline thereafter. Now, with mining production, typically what happens is if you have a prolonged downswing, workers are retrenched, very socially damaging, but when production, when demand firms up again, and when prices recover, people are sent back down to go dig up the mineral. But with manufacturing, by and large, plants are not generally put into long-term mothball. They are dismantled. The machinery is sold generally on the global market. The technical expertise, your technicians, your engineers, your skilled managers disappear. They each pursue their own interests. They may move to another city. They may leave the country. They may go into their own business. They may become demoralized and give up an interest in that sector and move to a totally different sector. Workers themselves are dispersed, and you lose that critical mass. And that's what technically is deindustrialization. It's not just a temporary dip in your output, but it's a permanent decline in your productive capacity. And it's a serious problem for us because South Africa is the industrial heartland of the African continent. And we are wishing very strongly with our policy prescriptions and our industrial policy initiatives to avoid becoming a continent that are what one can call the modern drawers of wood or hewers of wood and drawers of water, where we simply dig and plant and sell that to the rest of the world. And we remain trapped at the absolute bottom of the value chain in activities that, generally speaking, don't sustain decent wages, high technology, the kind of sophistication in an economy that can positively benefit surrounding industries and sectors and so on. So it's about more than just one auto plant. It's about fighting for a balanced economy, a balanced growth path, one where we have a strong and dynamic agricultural sector, and the Honorable Guniyama has drawn the attention to agriculture. And agriculture is critical for us. Rural development is a very important part of government's thinking, and we're going to be needing to do a lot more work on that. But at the same time, not just agriculture and mining, also manufacturing sector and a strong services sector and the connection between all of them. So, yes, I am taking the opportunity, Honorable Ntuli, of your question to make the general point about the importance of industrial policy and of ensuring that we have a manufacturing base at the end of the recession. The Honorable Mabaso's comments about the importance of assistance connected to work is well made. And I'm reminded, given the Honorable Feiling's comment about Paul Krugman, that Keynes, who was perhaps the economist most strongly associated with the measures to address the effect of the Great Depression, and who helped to lay through his work the foundations of much of the post-war economic order, Bretton Woods, some of the public policies of governments and so on. He famously said that in a depression or in a significant recession, it would make economic sense for a government to pay people to go and dig holes and then to go and fill those holes. It would make economic sense. Because what you do is you put money into people's hands, they become consumers, and those diggers of holes and fillers of holes then buy clothes, which require clothing workers, and they pay rates, which require local authority workers, and so on. Now, of course, in modern economies, we know that we can do a lot better than digging holes and filling holes. We can build dams, and we can build schools. We can do things that we need in the long term. And this is the moment when we ought to be digging into our resources to prepare South Africa for the position that it will face at the end of the recession. So a lot of our work is directed at that. And even with the training levy, the training layoff, I'm sorry, whilst we are very keen on ensuring we get the best possible training outcomes, even if we get half of what we aim at as a stimulus package, it already plays a role. But instead of being a passive benefit, we're tying it now to a commitment to training. So we get two benefits, two values for the society out of it. It is your classic stimulus package, but it's also a shortened and focused training program that will have some benefit for workers and for their companies. A number of members have raised the issue of cooperatives. I would make the point that there is vast scope for well thought through and well run cooperatives in the South African economy. The Honorable Gonyama reminded us of Mondragon, which is a set of cooperatives that are held together through a common framework in the Basque territory of Spain. And it was made famous by an excellent documentary that was shown on the cooperative. But there are countries, for example, in Italy, a very big part of the Italian economy is made up of smaller cooperatives. So there is an opportunity, but we have to reflect on the fact that we've not been as successful in South Africa as we can and need to be. And so that requires being quite critical about what it is that we need to do and doing what it requires. In other words, cooperatives are not going to grow by us asserting how important they are. They're going to grow if we find the right instruments to encourage them and to make them sustainable. And one of the key lessons that has come out of a very preliminary scan of cooperatives, it's very, very preliminary still, is that simply providing resources to people to form cooperatives is not enough. If there's not a significant investment in training, in financial and management skills, those cooperatives, however well intended, are not going to find a way of maintaining sustainability. We spoke the other day to the province of KwaZulu-Natal, who's done perhaps more than most provinces in promoting cooperatives, and we've asked them to do us a report on the do's and don'ts of cooperative development, because they've had so much lessons. And we said, all the mistakes you may have made, let that be school fees that's been paid that we can all learn from. And so we hope that out of this we can, in fact, come up with some thoughtful, focused ideas on cooperatives. We're not there yet. I'm not able to indicate that to you today, but we've identified this as an area that we need to do some very focused work together with the Department of Trade and Industry. The comments by the Honourable Tsetse is well made about ensuring that there is tax compliance when we provide support to companies, and also when there are these raids. We often find connections of illegality, that when people import illegally, they also quite often are involved in other acts of non-compliance, labor non-compliance, tax non-compliance. So the law, the state needs to ensure that it pursues all of those going forward. The Honorable Huang's made a number of points. I'm not going to be able to do justice to all of them, but I would simply say that one of the conversations we're having with the IDC is how to get a greater employment impact of its lending and funding operations. And that means creating a model in which we can see more transparently, for every unit of capital that the IDC invests, what is the employment impact, both direct and indirect. And if we're able to do that, not that every single decision will be taken only on the direct employment consequences. Sometimes you need a particular company as a supplier to an industry that can create large numbers of jobs. But there has to be a much more explicit targeting of employment by the IDC. And the IDC has said that that's what they wish to do. So they're now seeking to find ways of measuring the employment impact of their work. So I'm hopeful. The auto sector is important, and I have covered it previously, as is clothing and textiles. On the monies that's been earmarked by the Industrial Development Corporation, now 3.3 billion rand has not been allocated yet. It's just applications in the pipeline worth that amount. Now, not all of those applications may meet the criteria, and so once the IDC has processed all those applications and has made the necessary allocations, then we will know what is the remainder of the 6 billion rand. At the moment, it has allocated just over 700 million rand. I've put the figure on one of the slides here. The Honorable Kwabasi's comments about the framework and the work of government representing hope is appreciated. I will raise with the Minister of Health the points that has been made in respect of medical aid schemes and seek his advice and opinion on the matter. On companies not always utilizing fully their own productive capacity, which includes what the Honorable Kwabasi calls sophisticated technology, sometimes the deficit is in the training of workers and managers. And part of what the training layoff can do, it's an opportunity to companies. We can't compel companies, but we can say to them, here is an opportunity. If you've not utilized fully the capacity because of training constraints, and you've also lost orders and would ordinarily simply place people on short time or worse still retrench them, why don't you use this opportunity to get your skills base up so that you can utilize fully the capacity of your own plant? So I think the broader point that the Honorable Member makes is that one has to address simultaneously with dealing with these short-term challenges the broader need to ensure that we have viable sectors and enterprises. And that means addressing the need for innovation, for dynamic enterprises, and that of course requires a number of steps. One of it is training, and I've spoken to training. The other one is appropriate technology. Others are work organization issues, typical industrial engineering issues. There are a number of different programs in the DTI that are meant to address and support those. And the opportunity that companies have is they ought to be working not only with the training layoff that the Department of Labor is going to run, but also to access the resources of the DTI, so that it's in the combination that companies prepare for the future. The Honorable Khreiling's comments were very thoughtful, and I think we make the point that what we've announced to date are principally a short-term response. There are elements of it that goes to some of the longer-term elements, but they don't address all the systemic issues. And I would ask the question, is it not a key role of Parliament in opening up debates about this? We've got work to do as government departments on it. And in fact, the Economic Development Department will be doing some work in this area. But it's also an opportunity for the Portfolio Committee to engage on this, to get comments from experts and others, to provide an opportunity even for government to share some of the thinking and some of the debates and discussions taking place in the United Nations, in the G20, in the International Labour Organization. So in a recession, the voice of the people, which is Parliament, is also a place where we can stimulate very useful discussions and debates. And in that context, I'd like to note that it is our intention, it's not confirmed yet, but it's our intention on Wednesday, the 9th of September, and I hope someone confirms that Wednesday is the 9th of September, we would like to hold a policy platform on the global economic crisis, causes, consequences, and issues for policymakers. And we wish to host it here in Cape Town and invite members of the Portfolio Committee to attend. And we will ask two outside experts, two international thinkers, one from the University of Paris, the other one from the University of Cambridge, who are visiting South Africa for a few days, to address us and to share with us their thoughts. And it would be one of a number of such initiatives that we will take in the next few months to open up the discussion and the debates a little bit. So we look forward to your attendance. It will be after hours. It will probably start at either 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. It will probably be accompanied by supper, if Parliament will approve that as a useful, not fruitless expenditure. So you're invited to that. I think you raise a good question, which has also been raised by a number of Portfolio Committee members individually with me, and in fact was asked as a question in Parliament by the Chair of the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee to the President a few days ago. So we will follow that up. On some of the bigger challenges that you raise, to what extent are the physical constraints to growth? This is an age-old debate that economists have had for more than 100 years about whether there are physical limits to growth. What we have seen is the growth model over the last number of years, though, has not been very kind to the environment, that we've extracted at times in a way that's not sustainable, and of deep concern to all of us for the future of this planet is the compelling evidence of global warming that's a consequence in part of the kind of economic policies we followed. So whether there are physical constraints to growth or not, there are certainly huge costs to the environment that's generated by growth. There is an argument that increasingly has come up in the context of this crisis that there have been social constraints to growth with the existing model of economic activity. That when we see such, and this perhaps I can just bring a small aspect of what the Honorable Van der Westhuizen and then the Honorable Manamela raised. One looks at wage policies over the last 10, 15 years. the International Labour Organization, which is a UN agency, tripartite UN agency, has done work now. They've produced a global wage report, which shows that across countries, from developed to developing, labor's share of national income has been declining. And so out of the output of human beings, what business and labor collectively produce in the economy, the share that's gone to labor has been declining. Now the challenge that poses at a systemic level is if economies, through increased productivity, improve the supply of goods and services, but economic systems through their distribution have the effect of declining the purchasing power of workers. One way in which that slack is made up is through credit. So credit then becomes a major means of fueling consumption. And credit fueling consumption over a sufficiently long period becomes unsustainable. And when that credit bubble bursts, it's very painful on people across the world. So those are issues that are all the issues around the systemic questions that will come up in the discussion. I think most countries are just seeking to survive now, but everybody recognizes the world can't go back to where it was 14 months ago at the end of this crisis. The Honorable Ngonyama made a number of points. I would agree that one of the big challenges that recessions pose for governments, recessions expose the weaknesses in economies but also in governance arrangements, because societies need government to be particularly effective during a recession. And what our president has committed to is that instead of a defensive government that is in denial about the problems, we admit where we have problems and we commit to trying to improve within our capacity. And yes, one area that we need to improve is in management. And so no doubt in all of what we're going to do in the next many months, I have no doubt it's not going to be perfect, but we hope that there's a feedback loop where you as the representatives of our people hear the problems that are generated by the manner in which we implement, for example, the stimulus package, and give us that feedback, and we then adjust the way in which we implement. And in this process, we hope we can all improve governance going forward. On the skills issues that the Honorable Member raised, it is true that one needs to identify the anchor skills in the economy, and part of what GIPSA has attempted to do is to identify some of the skill the constraints and deficits and seek to address it. But in the training layoff, given that it's typically going to be for up to 3 months, it's not going to be able to address all the higher order skills that the country needs. For that, we need to get our education system working as effectively as possible, including the higher education system and further education and training, the CETA area. And in addition to that, what the training layoff does, it's not going to seek to fix all of that, because we won't have the capacity. It's a relatively small budget for the entirety of the education challenge. But what it can do is it can address skills bottlenecks in particular plants, in particular workplaces. It can do it on a generic basis. We saw the other day information that the mining CETA released on the level of literacy and numeracy among mine workers. Now, that is a challenge that can be grasped in this period. We've seen a digital divide in our society that's grown on information and communication technologies, where access and knowledge of computers, are confined to office workers, to white-collar workers, and where blue-collar workers have not been integrated into such a key tool of the 21st century. And yet smart factory production of the future is one that integrates ICT on the shop floor. So one of the opportunities, and again, as government, we can create opportunities now for businesses and unions to come forward and utilize it. One of the opportunities of the training layoff is to expose workers in production to information and communication technologies, a basic course on what a computer is, what the internet is, how ICT can be used on the shop floor to monitor production, to adjust quality, those kind of things. That's the kind of opportunity we're creating. And what Parliament can do in its advocacy role is to encourage the society, meaning business and labor, to tap into those opportunities that come out of this. It's to turn what is a serious challenge to us, a recession, into one where nonetheless we see opportunities in it that we are going to utilize. On the time frames issue, we've got time frames that we've announced publicly. I won't be able to go through all of them, but just to illustrate, for example, on the training layoff, it is our plan to commence the training layoff now in September, initially on a pilot basis to the sectors that are best equipped to implement it. After a six-week pilot, we think we would be able to open it to everybody immediately. We're seeking very, very much to work with existing institutions, with companies, with trade unions, so that there isn't a huge amount of time that has to be given to setting up systems. And we're confident that that will pay dividends. And we will have regular reviews of the training layoff. For example, if I take the IDC, they commenced implementation of their new distress sector fund already from the 1st of April. And they will now evaluate on a regular basis the level of take-up in the fund and whether it requires them to reconsider the level of resources they're going to allocate to it. So each one has got slightly different time frames. And that, when we do another presentation, we can look a little bit at the time frames more carefully. On the WTO, we certainly hope that South Africa's position can prevail. It is vital that we don't find ourselves locked into a multilateral commitment that will be damaging to our industrial interests. South Africa paid a very high price during the Uruguay round of the World Trade Organization talks because we were classified as a developed country. And you will recall the timing of it, that the principal discussions in Uruguay preceded 1994. The final agreement was signed, I think, a few weeks after our election in Marrakech, in Morocco, but the actual negotiations took place for a number of years prior to the transition. And as a developed country, we were therefore required to make deeper cuts to our tariffs than any of the developing countries. And we're now seeking in the Doha round to at least recover some of that, to say that that has been a historic injustice to South Africa that came at a point of deep vulnerability when we were in political transition. And we now need to be given a facility in the Doha round through increased flexibilities. There are two key terms that the negotiators use. The one is coefficients, which determine by how much you cut your tariff, and the other one is flexibilities, which indicates what percentage of your tariff lines can have a full or partial shield from liberalization. So we're seeking to have flexibilities that is consistent with what we require. If I can move a little bit more rapidly on some of the other issues, on the Honorable Rabi's questions, we've not considered any further action on the National Credit Act. It's a relatively new piece of legislation. But there is a interesting discussion going on about credit, which goes like this. to some extent, the fact that we put the National Credit Act in place before the recession may have assisted in ensuring that South Africa don't follow the normal trajectory on credit expansion that with a contraction caused so much damage in many economies. On the other hand, countercyclical theory says that in good times you must have tighter credit and in bad times you must have slightly looser credit. So economists have a number of different opinions on these things, and there's been no request by anyone yet for a review of the National Credit Act. So I think we take note of the point the Honourable Rabi has raised. The Honourable Van der Westhuizen says, and I think government is keen constantly to be dialoguing with both trade unions and with the business community. And we do so, of course, whilst respecting the constitutionally entrenched rights to collective bargaining that the parties have. And as the Honourable Manamela said, we are, as government, very keen to ensure that all industrial collective bargaining processes are lawful and that there's no resort to violence. So that's absolutely the critical ingredient for an orderly collective bargaining process and for democratically sound processes. On wages, I've started to talk about the issue earlier in response to an earlier question, but I've given a reply to a question that's been put to me on wages by saying that there's a very complex relationship between wages and jobs, because wages is on the one hand a cost, and economic theory would hold that if you can contain your costs, you become more competitive and you're able to be more efficient and gain market share and so on. On the other hand, wages is also a principal driver of consumption, and so it holds up aggregate demand. And since Keynes has been so famous in this portfolio committee today, Keynes, amongst others, made his name for the debate on wages during the Great Depression, where he argued that one shouldn't simply seek to have a generalized drop in wages, because if wages across the board were to drop during a depression, then the floor of your aggregate demand also drops. So these are complex relationships that we'll need to do more work on and produce some papers that can generate a bit of discussion and debate in the society. So we take note of the views that you've raised. And on Honourable Manamela, the points that you've raised, I think I've covered some of the points, and would simply say that as regards growth and jobs, which is the other relationship, it's also a complex relationship. And we want to do a lot more work as the Economic Development Department on ensuring that our growth path is a labor-absorbing growth path, that we are able to bring a large number of people into sustainable jobs through the structure of growth. And not every 1% of growth has the same employment impact. It can have different impacts depending on the composition of your growth. And societies with huge levels of unemployment seek to promote growth paths that absorb more of their people into employment, and that's a big part of what economic development work for the future will be. Chairperson, that brings to a conclusion the questions. I'm sure that there are some details that I may have missed here and there, but I hope I've covered substantially most of the questions that colleagues have raised. And I'd like to really just thank you for the opportunity and thank all of the many colleagues who made their complimentary comments on what government is doing on the framework. I will convey that to my colleagues and appreciate on their behalf your thanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister.
Sorry, Chair, if I can just to remind colleagues that the gremlin that crept in on slide 30, it should be three quarters. We don't want to lose more of our GDP than we need to. So if you can just adjust your hard copies.
Okay, thank you very much, Minister, for the responses, and I think they were adequately, the questions were adequately responded to. I will, because of the interest of of time, there's one area that I wanted to request maybe the Minister to look at together with the team at the negotiating forum. We are intending to spend 2.4 billion, and that will be coming from two areas, as you've indicated, from the UIF and from the Skills Fund, the National Skills Fund, which will then be put together into a National Jobs Fund, something like that. Yes. Since some of the areas that will be looked into are areas that are already covered by ABET, for instance, and looking at the possibility that that money won't be sufficient going forward, I thought maybe the issues around that we normally talk of integration and coordination of work should prevail now by ensuring that those programs that are already running could perhaps complement those that are still coming, especially by national departments, because they can tap on that, the funds that are already there, mostly because ABET funds are not exhausted in all government departments nationally. So that would, to me, complement a lot and would make a lot of impact. And then I hope the committee will agree with me in response to the issues that were raised by the minister here, especially around the role of the parliament as representatives of the people, that we will appreciate the minister coming for regular briefing to parliament. You can also continue making statements because they are really informing our communities, and they also are informing us much more better than we could be informed the other way around. The role of portfolio committee in ensuring accountability, Minister, I hope also here that the committee will agree with me that we should hold stakeholders participating in the whole, in the framework, accountable. And I wanted us to start by requesting the plan, for the plan. We need to know what they are intending, they are planning to do, with clear time frame, clear costing, so that we can be able to hold them, you know, accountable. Because, and also request on the part of government, especially the government on the issue of monitoring and evaluation, to also come out with that plan, that we can know as to what, at what stage will they be, for instance, evaluating progress and plans to that they will be taking, or actions that they will be taking if people do not want to comply, and that, Minister, will be coming from yourself, because unfortunately you are representing the social partners and the government in this committee. We will request that so that we can be able then to say, you promised us that this will be done by this time, and why is it not been done? Or even commend you if that has been done according to your plans. We will indeed help in popularizing our framework through our constituency offices. I guess we have a lot to do there. We can hold public meetings where we give feedback on what the government is doing to respond to the challenges. It is our role as public representatives, and that's why we have constituency offices. We will have to do that and assist you. And if the committee agrees, we will also be holding public hearings But unfortunately, we only have an allowance of two oversight functions to get out of this parliament twice this year because of budgetary constraints. But we hope that this, the term continues, we'll be able to be funded sufficiently so that we can do more. Yeah, this is what I think we will be helping you with in response to the issues that you've raised. In terms of the workshop, I mean, or the seminar, I don't know what you call it, but the policy platform that you've called, Minister, I think we'll await the formal invitation so that we can then forward it to members for them to avail themselves to attend. I take it that would then conclude the session with the other, our session with other committees, our sister committees. And let me just pass our sincere gratitude for, we are really glad that you joined us, and I hope that you've learned a lot, because we can only work together, because in working together we are able then to empower each other, which is very important. And I hope that especially the Select Committee, if you feel that there is a session you have and that is really empowering, feel free to also invite us. We will be able to attend. Knowledge is power, and the more we are informed, the more empowered we are. Thank you very much. I wanted the committee members to remain so that we can finalize the agenda. Minister, thank you very much. I remember signing and I understand that.